The headlines: Iran's president warns the U.S. not to waste time and lift anti-Tehran sanctions immediately in order to prepare the grounds for negotiations. The Yemeni military launches two consecutive attacks on a Saudi Aramco oil facility in Jeddah and a major military base in Asir province. And also in our headlines, defiant anti-coup protesters return to cities and towns across Myanmar a day after dozens were killed in the deadliest day of the junta's crackdown. Hello and welcome everybody here in the Iranian capital, Tehran. This is World News. Our top story for this half hour: Iran's President Hassan Rouhani says the 2015 nuclear agreement is a done deal and will not be changed. Rouhani said the Islamic Republic is ready for talks, but sanctions remain the main hurdle. He called on Washington to lift its anti-Iran embargoes in order to prepare the grounds for negotiations. Regarding the International Atomic Energy Agency, Rouhani called on the agency not to politicize Iran's nuclear program. He said Tehran is ready to resume any inspections under international law if its demands are met. The Yemeni army has launched an attack against an Aramco oil facility in Saudi Arabia. Army spokesman Yahya Sareh said the facility in Jeddah was targeted with a Quds-2 missile. There has been no immediate report of any damage. Earlier, he said the Yemeni forces also successfully hit the King Khalid Air Base in the kingdom's Asir province using drones. The Yemeni army and allied Ansarullah forces have intensified their attacks against Saudi Arabia in response to Riyadh's years-long aggression against their country that has left tens of thousands of Yemenis dead and devastated much of the country's infrastructure. The Saudi-led coalition has also maintained an all-out blockade on Yemen, hampering even the humanitarian aid there. Activist and political commentator Hossein Al-Bukhaiti says the Yemeni army's attack on Saudi facilities is a direct warning to Washington that Yemen would continue its fight against the dire situation imposed on the country.
Exactly what the international community should look like, should look at Yemen, that they have the right to defend themselves. As you mentioned, the UN latest UN report, which included that 400,000 Yemeni children under the age of 5 are facing death this year if there is no action or intervention will take place to stop that. And we see, actually, since Biden has took office, Saudi has blocked all ships that come in from Hodeidah, especially oil tanker. And this is actually has not happened during Trump administration. I mean, sometimes they let every now and then one or two ships to enter Hodeidah port, but Biden actually, he has enforced more blockade on Yemen, not allowing access to any ship carrying oil. And here the economy, especially hospital in Yemen, are dependent 100% on oil export from outside, and this action is affecting many hospitals and many businesses here in Yemen has closed, and many hospitals have warned that they're going to close in the coming days. That's why I think this latest attack is a direct message to the United States that the Yemeni army will continue to attack Saudi Arabia with all the means they have.
A barrage of rockets has hit the Ain al-Assad airbase in western Iraq, which hosts foreign forces, including U.S. troops. Security sources told Press TV that two American contractors were killed and six others injured in the attack. They said the type of the 10 rockets that targeted the base was similar to the model of the ones used by resistance forces between 2006 and 2010. According to the sources, the attack also caused material damage to the position of foreign forces inside the base. There's been no claim of responsibility so far. Also on Wednesday, Iraqi media reported three separate attacks on the convoys of the U.S.-led coalition. The Pentagon said Iraqi officials are investigating the attacks, adding that the U.S. won't shy away from a response if necessary. Political commentator Scott Bennett says the U.S. military presence in West Asia is unjustified.
Well, of course, the United States shouldn't even be in Iraq. It shouldn't be in Syria. It has no business being there whatsoever. It's been a terrible fiasco and a ruinous adventure which the Zionists and the neocons and the military-industrial complex originally launched after the fraudulent 9/11 attacks, which were part of this Odidinon plan to expand the political geography and control of Israel and the Israeli Zionist U.S. hegemony over the region. And I think the entire region is absolutely sick and tired of nearly 20 years of bellicosity and bloodshed by the United States, which has done nothing but ruin the Middle East. And the only hope of healing the Middle East is through the people and tribes and bloods that live there and letting them rejuvenate themselves by removing the toxic poisonous presence of the United States.
Anti-coup protesters have returned to the streets of Myanmar despite the junta's brutal crackdown that left nearly 40 people dead on Wednesday. Protesters in the cities of Douay and Yangon condemned the crackdowns and demanded the return of civilian rule. People also flooded the city of Mandalay while fighter jets were flying over their heads. Similar rallies were held in a number of other cities. The UN Special Envoy on Myanmar has described Wednesday as the bloodiest day since the military takeover of the country on February the 1st. Over 50 anti-coup activists have been killed and some 1,200 detained since then. The army seized power over allegation of voter fraud in November's elections. It also detained civilian officials, including de facto leader Aung San Suu Kyi. Political commentator Barry Grossman says the junta in Myanmar did not expect such public outrage over the February coup, since the Myanmarese had been used to living under the military rule.
In terms of the public response, I think they didn't expect this, you know, because the people of Myanmar had been used to living under military rule for a long time. Something seems to have changed to bring people with all sorts of different agendas together in order to protest this effectively a coup d'etat, even though the very same people that are protesting are standing beside other people who they're opposed to in many instances. So, for example, many of the protesters aren't in any way supportive of the Rohingya cause, and other protests aren't supportive of other minority causes that have been waged for a long time as a result of the hill tribes and other groups having an axe to grind with the military rule. So it's a big cock-up. Nobody really is ending up any better off, and certainly it's a tragedy to see so many victims, but of course it's the nature of authoritarian regimes that they will not tolerate anyone putting up any measure of resistance or protesting.
When the U.S. Secretary of State says his country's relationship with China is the biggest geopolitical test of the 21st century.
We will manage the biggest geopolitical test of the 21st century, our relationship with China. China is the only country with the economic, diplomatic, military, and technological power to seriously challenge the stable and open international system, all the rules, values, and relationships that make the world work the way we want it to, because it ultimately serves the interests and reflects the values of the American people.
Blinken said Washington's ties with Beijing may be competitive, collaborative, and adversarial, depending on the circumstances. He vowed that the U.S. would engage China from what he called the position of strength. Tensions between the U.S. and China escalated under the former American administration. The bones of contention include Beijing's South China Sea claims, trade, espionage, and the coronavirus pandemic. The administration of President Joe Biden has halted the harsh rhetoric and near-daily sanctions against China. However, it has yet to back away from the tough approach toward the Asian country. The United States and the European Union have imposed fresh sanctions on Russia over the alleged poisoning of and jailing of Kremlin critic Alexei Navalny. In our news review program, we discuss this issue in detail with our guests. Let's take a listen. On this news review, Russia has slammed as absolutely unacceptable the latest sanctions the U.S. and EU announced over the poisoning of Kremlin critic Alexei Navalny. The Kremlin said the sanctions amount to interference in Russia's domestic affairs. It said that Russia will take reciprocal steps in a way that best serves its interests. Earlier, the foreign ministry also warned the U.S. not to play with fire. It said the sanctions were evidence of a hostile anti-Russian lunge. The U.S. and the European Union imposed penalties on a number of Russian government officials and entities on Tuesday. The two say the Russian government was behind the last year poisoning of Navalny. Moscow strongly denies that. Joining us on this edition of the News Review, we have veteran journalist and commentator Fred Weir joining us from Moscow. Also, we have historian, journalist, and author Mr. Marcus Papadopoulos joining us from the British capital, London. Gentlemen, welcome to the program. Let's start off with Mr. Weir in Moscow. What are your thoughts on the recent sanctions implemented upon Moscow?
Well, these are targeted sanctions, that is, individuals, mainly in the security services, higher echelon government officials. And they're mainly people who aren't allowed to have bank accounts in the West or who typically travel there. So what Russia is really responding to is not the physical pain, but the insult, the sense that these sanctions just keep escalating. It's been 7 years now. They keep going on, ratcheting up every year for every reason. I think the Russians are trying to find language, perhaps gestures, to tell the United States and the European Union as well, in different ways, that it's enough, that we really need to break this cycle.
Marcus Papadopoulos, the Kremlin says that the sanctions amount to interference in Russia's domestic affairs. Do you agree with that assessment, and also give us your perspective on these recent sanctions?
Well, the Alexei Navalny affair has to be seen in the context of superpower rivalry, specifically that Russia is again a superpower, and America, the dominant superpower in the world, is attempting to undermine Russia's newfound status as a superpower. And the Americans are attempting to undermine Russia through a number of means, including the expansion of NATO to the western borders of the Russian Federation. We must remember that NATO is a dangerously criminal and violent military bloc. The Americans are also attempting to undermine Russia through the targeting of countries in the world which are strategic friends and allies to Moscow, including Cuba, Venezuela, Syria, and Iran. And the Americans are also attempting to undermine Russia through economic means, specifically sanctions. Now, the Americans care little for human rights, and the Americans in private know very well that Alexei Navalny's standing amongst the Russian public is negligible. The overwhelming majority of the Russian population do not just dislike Alexei Navalny, they loathe Alexei Navalny. They consider him to be an agent of the West. But for the Americans, they see Alexei Navalny as a useful tool in the demonization of Russia. They see Alexei Navalny as a pretext to introduce additional sanctions on Russia in the hope of asphyxiating the Russian economy, which would bring about a collapse of Russia's newfound status as a superpower, leaving America, as it was during the 1990s and for most of the 2000s, as the only superpower in the world. If the Americans sincerely believe that they have a case in support of Alexei Navalny, that he was poisoned, then they should share their scientific and medical findings with the Russian authorities. But they won't do that, which begs the question, why will they not share their findings with Russia? Interestingly, the British authorities never shared their medical and scientific findings with the Russians regarding what happened to the Skripals in Salisbury in 2018. And I would add this too. If the Americans and, of course, the British are genuinely committed to human rights, then they should really explain to the rest of the world why it is that they have such a close relationship with two countries in the world which flagrantly violate human rights on a daily basis and do not even respect the most basic concept of human rights. And those two countries which the Americans and the British have very close relationships with are Saudi Arabia and Israel.
All right, thanks a lot, gentlemen. Mr. Fred, we are joining us from Moscow. Also thanks to Marcus Papadopoulos joining us from the British capital, London. With that, it brings us to an end here on this edition of the News Review. Welcome back. Germany's flag carrier Lufthansa has reported a record loss in 2020 amid coronavirus-related travel curbs that grounded flights around the globe. Europe's largest airline announced it lost 6.7 billion euros last year. Lufthansa underlined that its recovery process would take a long time. The aviation giant said it expects to reach nearly half of its pre-pandemic capacity this year, adding that 90% of its capacity could be achieved only by the middle of the decade. The aviation has been one of the worst affected sectors by COVID-19 as it brought a sudden halt to traveling across the world. In Pakistan, the ruling party of Prime Minister Imran Khan has emerged as the single largest political force in the upper house of the parliament after Senate elections in the country. However, an alliance of most opposition parties in the Senate has made the electoral victory of Khan less significant, leaving him still dependent on the opposition for fresh legislations. Javed Rana has more in this report.
Jubilations among ranks and files of the opposition parties after the Senate elections in Pakistan. The combined opposition parties have managed to retain its majority in 100-member Senate. The Senate elections were held against 37 seats, and the ruling party of Prime Minister Imran Khan won 25 seats. Khan's party emerged as the single largest political force in the Senate for the first time. Nonetheless, Khan's party, together with its allies, is still short of six senators to gain majority in the Senate. Under the proportionate election systems, four provincial parliaments, together with the national parliament, elect 100-member Senate. After every 3 years, half of the senators retire, and regional and federal parliaments elect remaining members of the upper house of the parliament through secret balloting. Despite emerging as the single largest political force in the Senate elections, Khan's party suffered a major setback when the 342-member lower house of the parliament elected opposition candidate Yousaf Rza Gilani as the senator. Gilani is also the former prime minister of Pakistan. With the election of Gilani, the opposition is now eyeing at dislodging the prime minister. The opposition says Khan has lost majority in the National Assembly, which had elected him prime minister in 2018. Opposition candidate won the elections amid a video scandal on mainstream media showing agent of opposition offering tens of millions of dollars to win over MPs of the ruling party. Under pressure from the opposition parties, the government has announced that Prime Minister Imran Khan would soon take a fresh vote of confidence from the National Assembly. Analysts say that Khan is likely to retain his majority in the lower house of the parliament. Javed Rana, Islamabad.
And that brings us to an end here on this edition of the World News. Do stay tuned, though. Bye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
The U.S. Federal Aviation Administration, FAA, has slapped Boeing with a $6.6 million fine. It's pocket change compared to the multi-billion dollar fine the U.S. Department of Justice hit Boeing with earlier this year. The latest fine relates to Boeing's failure to meet agreed safety oversight changes dating from 2015. We now present you a news report written jointly by Eric Johnson and David Shepherdson. The piece is titled, Sources Say Boeing Hit with $6.6 Million FAA Fine Faces Much Bigger 787 Repair Bill. The piece has been published by the Reuters news agency. Please stay with us for more of Eric Johnson and David Shepherdson's article. Boeing will pay $6.6 million to U.S. regulators as part of a settlement over quality and safety oversight lapses going back years, a setback that comes as Boeing wrestles with repairs to flawed 787 Dreamliner jets that could dwarf the cost of the federal penalty. A third industry source said Boeing is being painstaking repairs and forensic inspections to fix structural integrity flaws embedded deep inside at least 88 parked 787s built over the last year or so. The person said the inspections and retrofits could take up to a month per plane and are likely to cost hundreds of millions of dollars, if not billions of dollars, though it depends on the number of planes and defects involved. Boeing shares extended losses in the final hour of trading, closing down 5.6% after Reuters first reported the settlement with the Federal Aviation Administration, FAA, over the plane maker's failure to comply with the 2015 safety agreement. The penalties include $5.4 million for not complying with the agreement in which Boeing pledged to change its internal processes to improve and prioritize regulatory compliance, and $1.21 million to settle two pending FAA enforcement cases. FAA Administrator Steve Dixon said in a statement, "The Federal Aviation Administration is holding Boeing accountable by imposing additional penalties. Boeing paid $12 million in 2015 as part of the settlement." A spokesman claimed by email the plane maker is strengthening processes and operations to ensure We hold ourselves accountable to the highest standards of safety and quality. Adding a settlement fairly resolves previously announced civil penalty actions whilst accounting for ongoing safety, quality and compliance process improvements. Two people said Boeing engineers are working to determine the scope of inspections, including whether jets can be used as is without a threat to safety. Another person said Boeing has not told airlines how many jets are impacted. People familiar with the proceedings said the Federal Aviation Administration, FAA, has been investigating instances of oversight lapses, debris left inside finished aircraft, and managers putting pressure on employees handling safety checks for the FAA. The people said the Federal Aviation Administration, FAA, has also wrapped into a single investigation three separate 787 defects arising over the last year that have triggered the invasive inspections. Boeing told the Federal Aviation Administration, FAA, in August of 2020 about the latest flaw involving structural wrinkling in the interior fuselage skin where carbon composite barrels that form the plane's lightweight body are melded together. A third industry source said the defect went unnoticed for months or even longer because computerized safeguards that crunch data looking for quality flaws had not been programmed to look for the gaps. The 787 production problems have halted deliveries of the jet since the end of October, locking up a source of desperately needed cash for Boeing. The fuel-efficient 787 has been a huge success with airlines, which have ordered 1,882 of the advanced twin-aisle jet, worth nearly $150 billion at list prices. But the advanced production process and sprawling global supply chain caused problems over the years. According to two people familiar with the matter, as of February, Boeing had fixed the 787 production process, causing the wrinkling defect. However, planes rolled off the assembly line with the flaw for more than a year at least, continuing even after the flaw was discovered in August of 2020. Boeing customer, Air Lease Corp's Chief Executive Officer John Pluger, told analysts on an earnings call on February 22nd, "It's difficult to see a definitive fix that is agreeable by the aviation authorities and all going forward." He added, "I don't think that we're there yet." Boeing has been working on three potentially hazardous defects as it chartered plans to consolidate final 787 assembly in South Carolina starting next month at a sharply reduced rate of 5,787 per month. One senior supply chain source said they will have to cut rates again, but another person close to the company said there was no discussion of an imminent cut. Boeing said last month it expects to resume handing over a small number of 787s to customers later this quarter. One person said it has an ambitious internal plan to deliver 100 of the planes this year. Analysts say deliveries are not expected to recover to 2019 levels until at least 2024. But before any jet is delivered, it must go through invasive inspections and costly repairs. According to three people with direct knowledge of the process, first, technicians must pull out the passenger seats, open up the floor paneling, and use specialty tools to measure whether defects invisible to the naked eye are present. The repair work, already underway at Boeing factories in Everett, Washington, and North Charleston, South Carolina, is even harder. They said in the bowels of the jet, technicians have to remove multiple specialty fasteners on both sides of the inner fuselage skin, then install newly produced shims that fill out gaps and remove the structural dimpling. Workers then replace all the fasteners, repaint, and reinstall the interior. One of the people said, "It's like open-heart surgery," adding, "They'll be retrofitting the fleet for potentially several years."
The Ain Al Asad military base in Iraq has been attacked. Even though the Pentagon says one U.S. contractor has been dead, other sources put the number of U.S. contractors dead at 2, with 6 injured. In this debate, we will look at how and why U.S. forces are being targeted in Iraq, and what this escalation could mean when it comes to heightened tensions between the United States and Iran. Our guest joining us, Brett Yonkers, is a historian and journalist who joins us from Hesselt. And we also have Elijah McNair, journalist and political analyst, joining us from Brussels. I'd like to welcome you both. Elijah McNair, let me first start with you. You have a couple of sources that have two different stats on this. First source saying that 10 rockets were fired, one U.S. contractor dead. That was due to a cardiac arrest. And then you have another source that says you have two U.S. contractors who are dead as a result, with 6 injured. First of all, tell us what your reaction is to this and where this may lead to.
Thank you for having me. So the main point is not how many contractors has been killed in this attack, or by heart attack, or have been seriously injured, or whatever. The main point is that the Iraqis are saying to the Americans, you need to leave the country. That is the main message. The attack was done from the area called al-Baghdadi, just a few kilometers away from Ain al-Assad military base, the largest American base. It is a Sunni area. The Americans started by bombing the Iraqi borders, killing a Sunni militant they called Iranian militia, which they got it completely wrong. They are Iraqi security forces who are on the borders protecting Iraq and preventing the crossing of ISIS from Syria to Iraq and hunting down ISIS in the desert. And the Americans started this new U.S. administration by Joe Biden, started by killing Iraqis. That is his first act of war and aggression, and it is not allowed for the Americans to carry attacks in Iraq because they are supposed to train the Iraqis. And the parliament asked them to leave, and they still there, and they don't want to leave. It is up to the Iraqi resistance to react. And when the Americans were in the country 2003 and occupied Iraq, when Al-Qaeda and other groups were attacking the Americans, they never went to bombard and kill the Iraqi forces. Why are they doing that? They are trying to create a war between the Americans and the majority Shia in the country, when Hashdi Shaabi is not made of Shia. It's made of Shia, Sunni, Kaldanian. All the composition and the bouquet of the Iraqi society, and the Americans insist in calling them Iranian militia, and these people are saying to the Americans, leave the country. That okay. is the message.
Well, Brent Yonkers, we're looking at the 10 rockets that were fired on this Ain al-Assad air base, and according to one of the sources, these were used by the local Iraqi resistance groups in the years 2006 to 2010, that these were those groups that were fighting against the occupation forces, as they were called. So this distinction needs to be made over here. What type of message is this sending, aside from the obvious one that obviously they want U.S. forces out?
Well, I think there is not really much else to be said, I think, except for the fact, indeed, that the Iraqis are fed up with everything, and that they are fed up with the occupation in any possible way, shape, or form, even if this comes in a way, in a claim of an American claim of fighting Daesh, fighting Al-Qaeda, and other terrorist organizations. Indeed, as has been pointed out, I don't have that much to add to it in this regard, that it is very clear that the Iraqi people across ethnicities, across sectarian divides, across religious divides even, Muslim and non-Muslim and like, are fed up with the U.S. arrogance and the U.S. occupation and the murderous tendencies that the United States has been displaying in Iraq ever since 2003. And it is starting to get to really wear down, I think, on the Iraqi people and even, I think, on the international community, especially, of course, in the Arab world, in the Islamic world, and across Western Asia, that these excuses that are being given, as well that we have seen today, when the Americans, the British, and the Danish, who incidentally also had two people in this base, are immediately pulling the card of saying, oh, you know, if you attack our forces, what you are doing is de facto siding with Daesh and Al-Qaeda because we are there to fight Daesh. This is really such a tired and ridiculous argument in a time when Daesh has been all but defeated and there's only some mopping up left to do. And the fact that they still are using this excuse at a moment when the Iraqis are more than capable nowadays in cooperation with their actual allies to mop up whatever resistance of terrorist forces is left, the fact that they still use this excuse is absolutely ludicrous. And I think this is something that has been that has been seen time and again. And we know for a fact that there are not some of these attacks that have happened in the past are not always necessarily traceable to Hashd al-Sha'abi. It is also, in some ways, these are militant groups that are not related to the popular mobilization units, but also in that other people, for example, Sunni groups that are either in Hashd al-Sha'abi or outside of it, who are just fed up with the fact that the Americans stay there. But we have to bear in mind, of course, indeed, as has been said, that the Joe Biden administration has killed an Iraqi serviceman and wounded several others in last week's criminal attack, bombing attack. What they claimed was in Syria, but according to some Iraqi sources, was actually taking place on Iraqi soil near the border, and has in this way again violated Iraq's territorial sovereignty, which has led groups such as Harakat al-Nujaba, which is of course part of the Hashd al-Sha'abi, to claim that whatever agreements of ceasefire they had with the occupation forces for the time being have been cancelled now, and this is the time of retaliation. And this retaliation is completely justifiable, especially, as we all know, because of the fact that the Iraqi parliament has demanded U.S. troops to leave. The fact that they haven't done that makes them an occupation force that is basically comparable to the occupation force right after the invasion of 2003, and as such, they are legitimate military targets.
I would think that it's a viable question to ask here, Elijah McNair, a general one, and that is, why are the U.S. forces on Iraqi soil? What purpose does Iraq serve for them? We know the stated goal at this point right now, based on what the Americans have said, is that they are fighting the Daesh forces. But is that what it is? Is that the reason why they are so keen on staying in Iraq?
Well, that's a very good question. No, they're not there to fight ISIS. They are there to prevent the connection between Iraq and Iran. They are there to prevent the connection between Iraq and Syria. They are there because of the oil. They are there to make sure that they have a base to that is near Iran, and they can use this base in case they want to declare war on Iran or they want to hit targets, as they did with General Soleimani in January 2020. They are not there to fight ISIS because the government declared ISIS defeated. And of course, ISIS has been defeated all over Iraq as an occupier of cities. The insurgency will remain and will always remain. The Americans never managed to get rid of Al-Qaeda in Afghanistan, notwithstanding 20 years of occupation. And they're not getting rid of Al-Qaeda in Syria. On the contrary, they financed Al-Qaeda in Syria. So it is not a question of terrorism. It's not a question of Al-Qaeda. It's a question of standing between those who reject the U.S. hegemony and the Middle East and wants the U.S. And they want to impose their will, and they want to impose their strength and their power over the population of Iraq. And Iraq is a very rich country of oil, one of the richest of oil. And the Americans always said, we want the oil. It doesn't mean they need the oil, but they want to control the energy. And who control the energy, control the world. And this is the aim of the Americans. And we see an increase of ISIS activity when the Iraqis start asking from the Americans to leave. Now we watch France stepping in and doing the dirty laundry of Joe Biden and saying ISIS is expanding in Iraq, and then Americans are saying ISIS is expanding in Syria to justify the presence of the Americans and some European countries in Iraq and in Syria. And what they are doing, they're blocking the commerce between Iraq and Syria to prevent the recovery of Syria. This is why they are in Iraq. They have multi-purposes, multi-objective, and they all against the inhabitants of the Middle East, and in particularly the people of Iraq and Syria.
Okay, you're looking at a week and weeks, Brett Yonkers, where you have had an uptick, an increase in U.S. forces and U.S.-backed forces or U.S.-led forces in Iraq to be targeted. You had what happened with that Erbil incident, in which the U.S. as a result carried out an airstrike targeting what it seems to always be using, Iran-backed militias is what it says, in Syria. That was the first military action taken by Biden. Now, first of all, the response that came on this from Iran was, you know, you are now encouraging terrorism in the region because you have fighters there in the Syria who are fighting Daesh terrorists. So this goes back to the fact that how the U.S. either shields them, supports them indirectly, covertly. Do you agree with what Iran has said regarding that? And is it decision time for the U.S.? We know that under Biden now, the military offensive took place. And now with this past week's increase, is it time for the U.S. to start rethinking what it's doing in Iraq, or will it take a military approach like it did just 5 days ago?
It's always, of course, a big question when it comes to what the United States will do. And in that regard, it is interesting to see that the differences between and the differences and the similarities between Republicans and Democrats in that regard are always quite interesting, because as warmongering and aggressive as Donald Trump was, he is actually the person who has scaled back on the deployment in Iraq. And now under Joe Biden, the so-called, who was elected by some people, let's say anti-war candidate, we see an increase in aggressive rhetoric and aggressive deeds in Iraq. They have killed, as I said, Iraqi citizens, either right across the border in Syria or right across the border in Iraq. But no matter what it was, they have struck Iraqi targets de facto. So when Iran says, and a lot of sources in Iraq as well say that this is an attack that is unjustifiable and an attack that de facto helps terrorist organizations, this is definitely true. There are now sources in Iraq that are saying that by targeting the border areas, the Americans have opened the border for Daesh and Al-Qaeda terrorists to come from northeastern Syria back into Iraq, which is interesting because a lot of these terrorists were originally active in Iraq and then went to Syria during the Syrian civil war, of course, when during the height of the flare-up of the violence in Syria back in, let's say, 2013, 14, and 15. A lot of these people went to Syria in order to massacre and terrorize the population there on behalf of the Americans, on behalf of the Western coalition, and of the so-called, you know, the Syrian National Army, Syrian Free Syrian Army, and things like that. And now that they are gradually losing ground in Syria again, some of these people are being redeployed, of course, underground and under cover of U.S. protection, redeployed in Iraq. because this insurgency is still ongoing, as indeed has been said. Daesh has been defeated as a political entity, as an entity that actually controlled a significant amount of territory, but is still continuing as a standard terrorist organization comparable to Al-Qaeda. And one of the reasons why they keep on doing this is that Americans keep on, in fact, supporting them. We know there are numerous reports already from years and years ago of Daesh terrorists surrendering, quote-unquote, to the coalition forces led by the Americans in Syria and being granted de facto amnesty and airlifted back into Iraq. Of course, completely without asking the permission of Baghdad. And this is one of the things that is really unjustifiable and really disgusting about this entire situation, is that so many things are happening in Iraq without the Iraqis having been asked anything. You have certain Kurdish fighters coming in from the Kurdish regions of Turkey. You have the Turks invading Iraq in order to fight those Kurdish forces, again, without asking the Iraqis. You have Daesh forces being trafficked into Iraq and then bombed by U.S. forces without, you know, talking to the Iraqi government itself. And this is something that I think when the Islamic Republic of Iran speaks out against this, they are often accused of, let's say, meddling in Iraqi affairs. But in fact, what I think what Iran is doing is basically just standing up for the national sovereignty of their neighboring state, of the Republic of Iraq. Mm-hmm. And the American actions in Iraq have time and time again caused a massive destabilization, especially in the border areas, especially in the oil-rich areas, and have continued this U.S. policy of occupation, destruction, and balkanization,
right,
that they have been doing for decades across the West and Asia. So I think Iran definitely has a very good point when they're saying that this is a massive handout that is being given to terrorists across the region.
Elijah McNair, I mean, just a thought here. Maybe the whole game plan behind the U.S. When it does attack, for example, what it did with Syria on the borderline between Syria and Iraq, and for its presence there in Iraq, is to, in their viewpoints and in their eyes, trying to cut off any relationship that Iran has with Iraq and in turn with Syria. We know that Israel, obviously staunch U.S. ally, keeps bombing Syria, and we know that U.S. presence in Iraq creates this instability, and therefore it wants these two countries, Iraq and Syria, to turn their backs against Iran. Could that be a mentality of the U.S. behind any moves that they make in terms of their presence or any actions that they take?
That's one of the points, and one of the major points. So we see the American presence in northeast Syria has been used as a base for Israelis to come and use the military airport there and to bomb Syria from the static position of the Americans on the border. And we saw the Israelis using the U.S. facilities by going and bombing the Iraqi security forces warehouses and assassinating commanders of Hashd al-Sha'bi while traveling between Baghdad and the borders. And also, we see the presence of the Americans on a Tanakh crossing, a road that I've done endlessly. That's a very short road between Damascus and Baghdad. And that road, on the borders, the Americans have established the very large base, military base, for which reason there's no reason for them to be there at the exception of blocking the commerce. And one of the things that the Americans went completely mad about is when General Qasem Soleimani went to Deir ez-Zor and liberated Al-Qaim and freed the border between Iraq and Syria before the arrival of the Americans that had the intention to jump from Tanakh to Al-Qaim and close that border to cut off Syria completely from Iraq. And that was one of the main reasons why the Americans are bombing always in that area. And I would like to add, very important, the Prime Minister of Iraq, Mustafa Kazemi, sent a delegation 2 days ago to the borders to make sure that the bombing was on the Iraqi side, not on the Syrian side. And to his discovery, it was confirmed on the Iraqi. That means the Americans lied to him. And even if they did, he was not up to the standard of a Prime Minister to stand up to the Americans and condemn their actions against his own military forces because he is the commander-in-chief. So the Americans not only violate Iraq's sovereignty, but they also lie to the prime minister and go and attack the borders to make sure that Syria is going to be completely crippled economically, and this is why they have imposed also the Caesar Act sanctions on the Syrian population to starve the population. And these sanctions always are used against the population in Venezuela, in Syria, in Iran, Lebanon.
Final question goes to you, Bert Jonkers. We had one of the Democratic representatives say, we quote, "We ran on ending wars, not escalating conflicts in the Middle East. Our foreign policy needs to be rooted in diplomacy and the rule of law, not retaliatory airstrikes without the authorization of Congress." This is what Biden did. This is the reaction it got. Do you think that the U.S. is going to escalate its actions militarily now that we have seen this attack take place on Ain al-Assad?
Well, in this regard, I prefer staying somewhat optimistic. When analyzing a similar situation recently, being the one in Yemen, which is, of course, even much worse than the situation that is happening, unfortunately, in Syria and Iraq, I have bumped on that on the similar issue that there's a growing anti-war movement now in the United States. It's not as big as the anti-war movement was in the beginning of when the Iraq war was going on, the anti-war movement then, but it's something that is growing. And what is hopeful, of course, with certain reservations, with certain grains of salt, of course, to take it for anything an American politician says, but what is sort of hopeful is that there are more and more people who refuse to just take the word of the president, take the word of this and that politician for it, and then just settle down and hope that it will happen. You see people on both sides of the aisle, both Republicans and especially Democrats, now criticizing Joe Biden and saying, this is not what we voted for, we want out, it is time to really get out of these undeclared wars. So I hope that this will indeed continue and that this anti-war movement will eventually bear fruit.
Thank you for that, Brent Jonkers, historian and journalist. And thank you very much, Elijah McNair, journalist and political analyst. Thanks for tuning in to another edition of The Debate. From Mika Vitale, entire team in the capital, Tehran, is goodbye.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran by a shortwave 41 meters, 7,300 kilohertz every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran by a shortwave 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa by a shortwave 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked.
The Holy Prophet of Islam is the example.
Self purification is the most significant factor.
Imamat is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism. This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Welcome to another episode of Ulama's Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short Farsi speech by Hujjatul Islam Nasser Rafi'i. Please stay tuned. Sometimes our dear brothers and sisters come to us and ask why our prayers are not answered. The answer to the question is in Ayah 11 of Surah Al-Isra, which states, "Man prays for ill as avidly as he prays for good, and man is over hasty." The main theme of this ayah is that sometimes the human beings hasten in order to get the answer to their supplications. However, they don't know that they must not hasten to get the answer to their prayers and that they must be more patient. This haste of them will give them ill instead of good. Maybe the answer to their request is not given soon, but there is goodness in that answer for them later. Therefore, we must not hasten in getting the answers to our prayers and requests from Allah, and we must be more patient so that our prayers are answered on the right place and right time. Thank you very much, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, for listening to this episode of Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Nasser Rafi'i. To find out more about this program and our other programs, log on to our website.